Jamaica in the 18th century was England's most important asset in the Caribbean. It was the largest island in the British West Indies, 140 miles long and 40 miles at its widest part. The eastern parishes were overhung by mountains that rose to 7,000 feet over the Liguenia Plain, dominated the magnificent harbor of Kingston, and subsided into ranges of rugged hills in the western parishes. Skirting the mountains and in the valleys, wedged between their ranges, were the 2 million acres of rich earth worked by slave labor that were the basis of Jamaican wealth. By 1763, Jamaica produced more sugar than all the other British West Indian islands put together. The development of Jamaica added to the worldwide trade network that stimulated British commercial expansion. In the early 18th century, the island was a component in the Great Triangular Trade, one of the most nearly perfect commercial systems of modern times, which brought British manufacturers into Africa, African laborers into the land masses of the Americas, and tropical products into the markets of Europe. When this trade pattern shifted, Jamaica retained links with Africa and Britain, and added links with Britain's North American colonies, where saltfish, lumber, and plantation supplies were purchased. Participation in this intercontinental trade gave Jamaica's ruling class opportunities to make immense personal fortunes. They adorned their plantations with domestic palaces and dazzled London society with displays of conspicuous consumption. Within the island, planters dominated every branch of government. They were members of the Jamaican Assembly, which claimed constitutional parity with the House of Commons and, in fact, enjoyed real bargaining power through its control of taxes and supplies. 12 Assembly members were chosen to serve on the Governor's Advisory Council. In their parishes, they served as magistrates of the petty session courts and as chief magistrates, called custodes. They also sat as judges in the assize courts. The island only had one professional judge, the Chief Justice, appointed by the Crown, who presided over the grand courts held quarterly in each of the three counties, Middlesex, Surrey, and Cornwall. 2 non-professional assistants, recruited from the white ruling class, shared the bench with him in the grand court, and 3 non-professionals presided in the quarterly assize courts. This concentration of authority put the island's internal affairs effectively into the hands of a small, white squirearchy comprising about 50 families. Within this structure, the planters enjoyed virtually unlimited power over the slave population. Officially, their power was limited by the slave codes formulated by the Assembly, but no provisions were made to administer those clauses designed to protect the slaves, which defined hours of work, appropriate punishments, leisure time, or rations. The planters' primary interest was simply to keep the slaves under control. So, living standards were low, work hours long, and punishment, usually flogging with a cart whip, harsh and arbitrary. The free colored and black population was also kept strictly subordinate to the whites and enjoyed no legal or civil rights. In the imperial framework, however, the Jamaican planters were ultimately at the mercy of the British government, which determined their terms of trade, reviewed their legislation, and sanctioned the supply and use of slave labor. The planters, consequently, made every effort to protect their interests by exerting influence at Westminster. From 1682, the Jamaica Assembly, like its counterparts throughout the British Caribbean and in North America, employed agents in London to keep it informed of political trends in the capital, to provide British ministers with information and opinions independently of the island governor, and to organize lobbies on particular issues. As their wealth increased, some of the Jamaican planters established themselves in England as absentee landlords and acquired seats in Parliament. The West India interest, which included both planters and merchants, emerged early in the 18th century. By 1761, they formed a considerable lobby composed of an inner ring of 13 West Indians, including 7 Jamaicans, and an outer ring of 8 or 9 associates. The parliamentary lobby was supported by associations of the West India planters and merchants formed in the principal West Indian trade centers, Bristol, Glasgow, and London. Through these associations, and particularly through the London-based associations, which formed the Joint Committee of West India Planters and Merchants in 1775, the absentees were able to exert considerable influence on their fellows in the West Indies and, at the same time, establish strong personal relations with influential members of the British government. Until the last decades of the 18th century, the West Indians' chief problem was to maintain and extend their sugar marketing privileges within the British Empire and in Europe. The British West Indies supplied Britain and its North American colonies with sugar, but both markets limited their profits. In Britain, the government charged high customs duties and insisted on British merchants handling the re-export of sugar to the continent. In North America, illegal trade with the French Islands, which supplied duty-free sugar and molasses in return for food and lumber, created competition. The West India interest successfully tackled both these problems. In 1733, they secured the passage of the Sugar or Molasses Act, intended to suppress North American trade with the French Islands, through the introduction of prohibitive duties on the import of foreign sugar and molasses into the British American colonies. The act was never successfully enforced and had to be revised in 1766, but this initial West Indian triumph over the North American interests was followed in 1739 by a victory over the British sugar interests when permission was given to export sugar directly to the European continent on the sole proviso that ships trading north of Cape Finisterre must touch at a British port. Little sugar was in fact exported because the British internal market was expanding, but the threat of a rival market boosted sugar prices in England and increased the planters' profits. The British West Indian sugar planters maintained some marketing privileges in Britain until 1854, though their preeminence as world sugar producers was lost during the Napoleonic Wars. In the last decades of the 18th century, however, the British West Indians found that the relationship with the mother country could no longer be conducted on a straightforward commercial basis. British society was itself undergoing transformation, and its West Indian colonies were, willy-nilly, involved in this process. The Industrial Revolution altered Britain's economic base. In the course of 2 generations, manufacturing became a mainstay of the national economy and industrialists, a key element in the ruling class. This upheaval, which affected every class in the society, together with the wars and revolutions of the period, forced both secular and religious thinkers to review the newly emerging economic and social order and to formulate critiques. It was these ideological developments, characteristic of Britain's industrial takeoff period, which first touched the West Indian planter interest by making slavery a political issue. The attack on slavery was formulated in religious terms, and from first to last, practicing Christians provided leadership for the cause. Slavery was also condemned, however, by political radicals across a wide spectrum, ranging from Tom Paine to the Whig politician Charles James Fox, and by political economists, most notably Adam Smith. The social and moral dislocation attendant on the economic transformation of society, prompted a religious revival characterized by emphasis on the fundamentals of the Christian message, the imperatives of sin and salvation. This emphasis provided the dynamic for a reassertion of Christian values both among the growing conglomerations of heathen urban poor, removed from the traditional supervision of squire and establishment parson, and among the nominally Christian wealthy. The results were seen in the revival of existing sects, the formation of the Wesleyan Methodist Church, and the multiplication of charitable trusts and charitable causes that comprised the humanitarian movement. It was the reinterpretation, in 18th century terms, of the concept of sin that for the first time designated slavery as sinful. The radicals arrived at the same conclusions by a different route. Their ideas derived not from evangelical Christianity, but from the religious radicals of the 17th century, whose conflict with the state had prompted the acute critiques of government developed and secularized by the philosophers of the Enlightenment. For the radicals, chattel slavery symbolized the political slavery of citizens chained to a state structure that embalmed privilege and functioned by corruption, that denied political office to dissenters and Catholics, and representation to developing sectors of propertied citizens. Their minimum demand was constitutional reform, their maximum, universal suffrage. But all radicals perceived in slavery the ultimate in human and political degradation and considered freedom for the slaves a necessary assertion of the rights of man.